Welcome. This is Catherine Austin Fitz. It's Saturday, November 23rd, and this is a special Salieri report, which we just realized we were doing, I don't know, about 30 minutes ago.
About 30 minutes ago. We should have been recording.
I'm sitting here with Dr. Joseph Farrell in his incredible office filled with books I'm dying to read or some I've read too. And but surrounded by the library, and we've been talking about a headline.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, and one of the reasons I so appreciate talking with Joseph is I will find these little tidbits that I think are incredibly instructive about where the world is going, and I'll share them with people, and they'll kind of yawn, but I share them with Joseph, and he goes,
oh, my God.
Oh, my God. So last Thursday, as I was doing the Salieri report, I came upon the fact that the Vatican had hired Ernst & Young, now called EY, a global, one of the top CPA accounting firms, to come in and help straighten up and audit the books and records of the Vatican administration. And there's an implication they'll be working with the Vatican Bank as well, all by the new Pope Francis, who's this is part of the reforms. Everybody's reforming now. So I explained this to Dr. Farrell, and he said,
oh, my God.
Because this is to bring a independent auditor, you know, and the independent auditors have been deeply involved in all of the financial machinations, and I personally have experienced them, you know, being part of the financial machinations, to bring this, a company that is based in the city of London.
Yep.
It's a London-headquartered global network.
Alarm bell number one.
Right. So I said, okay, this is really a major event, and let's see who they're aligned with. So the first thing we did is we looked at their leader who worked at the Treasury under Rubin and Summers, mm-hmm. you know, is an American tax accountant who's the chairman. But then I said, okay, let's look at who E&Y is currently serving as the auditor. And what did we find? Oh,
we found the Bank of International Settlements.
Which is the central bank to the central banks. In Switzerland.
In Switzerland. Basel, Switzerland.
And so as part of this came up in a conversation we were having about, you know, how did the financial coup d'etat work? How is that related to the growth of the breakaway civilization? Where are they going? And how are we going to evolve the financial and economic model on planet Earth? Because clearly the central banking warfare model is coming to a head. So this was all part of a conversation of how the economic model is evolving.
Right.
And the fact that the central bank of central banks is sharing an auditor
with the Vatican.
With the Vatican at a time when we know the Vatican model is under tremendous pressure, stress, evolution, and it's happening at the same time what we now see as a result of the NSA scandal, balkanization of the internet. Clearly something very significant
is going on. Yeah.
Right.
You know, just for listeners to recall the history of the BIS, I think is important, first of all. The BIS was founded in the interwar period between the world wars to handle the war reparations payments from Germany to the Allies. And the brains behind this thing, as you know, are Montagu Norman, then the head of the Bank of England, and then Benjamin Strong of the New York Federal Reserve Bank. And then finally, and most importantly, my favorite in this triumvirate of malfeasance was Hjalmar Schacht of the Reichsbank, who, of course, goes on to become Hitler's Reichsbank president. And the BIS was really Hjalmar Schacht's brainchild. And he was the one that read into the charter for this bank that it would have a kind of semi-sovereign status, that in the event of war, no one would go after any of the warring parties, presumably thinking ahead of time here, the Western Allies versus Germany, would go after the BIS. So you have effectively a semi-sovereign bank in the BIS, the Central Bank of Central Banks, being audited by the same firm now that is auditing the bank of another sovereign entity, which is the Vatican City State. And this is major. And the other reason I think it's significant, and we talked about this very briefly, is that the Vatican Bank became not only one of the for the post-war laundering of covert funds back into Europe for covert operations, principally the Italian elections of 1948. We know that episode. But it was also one of the major hubs for Emperor Hirohito to move all of the liquid assets that he could out of Operation Golden Lily into Western banks. And the bank that he chose to do this was the Vatican Bank. So there's that background. But you had another even bigger scenario.
Because I look, when my vision of the Vatican and the church, the Catholic Church, is that you know, Rome basically said, we cannot afford to maintain a standing army.
Right.
Everywhere.
Right.
And what they did was they pulled back behind the cover of a church,
right,
which was essentially a way of managing enormous pools of intergenerational capital. And I've spent a lot of time studying...
Tax-free.
Tax-free. So yeah. You have the Knights of Malta and Opus
right.
Dei, who enjoy diplomatic immunity in various forms.
Right.
Then you have the tax exemption, and you have the imprimatur of the church.
Right.
And the church, the storefront church, until the telecoms have now taken over, basically manage the ultimate control file network everywhere. So you,
right.
And that gave you the power to enforce your equity positions, because no one moves money or leaves money where they can't enforce.
Right.
And the question is, if you don't have a standing army there, how can you enforce? Well, the storefront churches, combined with the Jesuit networks, and I believe it was very much the Jesuits left behind managing the money, gave you a formula that worked. And so the armies could pull back, and you could be running what is arguably the most significant pool of intergenerational capital.
Absolutely.
Now, it all wouldn't be owned legally by the church. It would be in many, many different pots.
Oh, yes.
You know, I've gone back with a dear friend and studied Vatican II, and seeing essentially how basically all the assets that got built up by the nuns got liquefied and the money put into different pots of money management
right.
to be part of this network.
And that's very significant, what you mentioned just there, the Vatican Council, the Second Vatican Council, looked at in that way is as much about finance as it
right.
is about church reform. And what people need to understand, what you're saying here in terms of the structure of the Roman Church, is you have several different, what in Roman Catholic canon law would be considered ordinary bureaucracies. You have the hierarchy itself, the bishops, the archbishops, the cardinals. They manage the equity and the assets of their local diocese directly,
right.
all right? So you've got one level of equity. Then you have the religious orders themselves, the oldest of which actually would be the Benedictines in the Western Church. They would manage their own order's assets. You add to this the Cistercians, the Franciscans, the Dominicans, the Jesuits, and on we go. Each of these orders has their own separate independent finance. All of it coming underneath the bureaucracy of the papacy itself, which in turn has its own independent administration of the Vatican City-State.
Right.
So you're sitting, like you said, you're sitting on top of an enormous, centuries-long pile of accumulated assets that have been quite literally
taxed.
The real estate assets are unbelievable. You know, yeah, and art and everything else.
Right. And the beauty of their control file system was you have these storefront churches that are generating tithes.
Yes.
So it's basically the population is paying you
right.
to manage the control file system, and that control file system gives you the power to make the equity really go and to protect it and enforce it.
Right.
And that's why what has now happened with the telecoms and the intelligence agencies is so powerful, because that's gone from being a way, you know, a for-profit control
right.
file system to
right.
a not-for-profit system that can't compete.
Now, let me add one more historical perspective here for your listeners. You mentioned control files, and I think this is the other part of the equation people have to understand. This is the hidden influence behind the Inquisition. The Inquisition is really a matter of keeping control over the thought, control over any independent movements, precisely in order to
right.
keep all. So in other words, what I want people to start thinking of in terms of that whole apparatus of repression and so on is that this is the enforcement mechanism during the Middle Ages of the control files. And right. for that matter, we could even say that some of the Crusades are the Albigensian Crusade, the Fourth Crusade, and so on. These are all manifestations of the enforcement apparatus of the control files. By the time of the Fourth Crusade...
How was the... Because I thought the Crusades were really acquisition.
Well, they were in terms of most of the Crusades to the Holy Land. But the Albigensian Crusade was an internal affair in southern France against the Cathars.
Right.
And the Fourth Crusade, of course, was the Crusade that was manipulated quite literally by Venice to sack Constantinople. Well, at that point in history, the Eastern Church had told the papacy, you know, you've broken away from us, so go your way and we're going to go ours. So you could look at the Fourth Crusade even as another manifestation in a certain sense of,
right,
of this.
Right, because the Cathars were too independent.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And they had a different, a fundamentally different cosmology, which if not checked, you know, we got into this in Financial Vipers of Venice a bit, if left unchecked would have threatened not only the cultural power, the political power right. of the church, but the financial power of the church. Because, again, those are assets... At that time in history, the Languedoc in southern France was very wealthy, and this was all Cathar wealth, and it was, again, tied into the Templars and so on and so forth. So, yeah, we're dealing with a very big story.
It's so funny you said that what you said about the Inquisition, because I felt I was driving up today, and I said, you know, there are days I feel like Sean Connery in The Name of the Rose, where I travel
yes.
through this medieval world and finding pockets of civilization.
Yes, yes, exactly. Yeah, but anyway, I didn't mean to get it sidetracked there with the historical note, but I think it's important for the model that you're developing here
well,
to interject that.
You know, to me it's very current, because what was the office that the last pope had run?
Oh, Benedict, yeah, the Congregation of Propagation of the Faith. Yeah, that's basically the Holy Office, the Inquisition.
Right.
So, yeah, it's still in existence.
know, like oh, I would say it's still happening.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Well, it's, you know, this is another tangent, but I was wondering, you know, yesterday was the 50th anniversary of Kennedy, who was the
right.
first Catholic president.
Yes.
And it's, I was just watching up on Lou Rockwell's website the video of the Secret Service being waved away from
away
the back,
from, yes.
the back of his car. And you wonder, okay, what was the Vatican's role in all of this? What was...
I don't know if it had a direct role, but there is a kind of a roundabout indirect connection through a lot of the mafia involvement.
Right.
So, in other words, you would have had, if we look at the Kennedy assassination from the standpoint of people that argue like Oliver Stone that Kennedy's threat to smash the CIA was a threat against the power structure of the deep state in America, the breakaway civilization and so on. You could also argue that by taking direct aim at the mob and the CIA, he's taking direct aim at part of that hidden financial structure that very directly plugs into the Vatican.
Right.
So, yeah, there may have been a quiet, tacit Vatican role, but we probably will never know exactly what it was. But, yeah, I think it's possible.
Well, it's interesting. There's a book, wonderful book by a scholar about the effort of the sort of Masonic networks to checkmate and sort of castrate the church in the big cities using
yes.
the HUD and housing programs.
Yes.
It's quite good. And so, you know, it's always hard to figure out when everybody's cooperating and
right.
when they're at war, because I know back in Philadelphia it was the, you know, everybody cooperated to run the drug business and to
mm-hmm.
do all of this stuff, and yet there was deep
right.
warfare going on too.
Oh yes, absolutely.
So it's, I find it always murky. Well, so Ernst & Young is into the Vatican. Another thing I wanted to point out, since they are, you know, the European office is out of London, but they're doing the BIS and they're clearly present in Switzerland. It's the Swiss Guard that
yes.
that provides the security force
for
the Pope and the Vatican.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so this may just be the Swiss extending their protection into...
Yeah, I think we're really confronted here with several possible logical scenarios, and like you, I'm not really certain which we're staring at yet. Ernst & Young, as you pointed out when we were talking earlier, is one of these accounting firms that's known how to cook the books. So the question becomes, since the public story that we're being told is that Francis is trying to clean up Vatican finances. And I think you're absolutely correct. I think he's trying to assert papal control and authority over this right. whole big monster that's gotten out of control after Vatican II, or reassert it, I should say. But we can look at Ernst & Young coming in to audit the Vatican Bank one of two basic ways, I think, and how which one of these will play out, time will tell. The first is that they were brought in so that they could examine the previous audits of the Vatican Bank and determine whether or not the books were cooked. Now, I think that's probably unlikely, because most likely anybody who's in any position of power or knowledge within the Vatican is going to know that they've been cooked.
Let's just bring up one important fact, which I didn't mention, and that is we know in September that Francis had published, I think for the first time, the annual report for the Vatican Bank.
Right.
So that's September, and then now in November,
Ernst & Young
suddenly right. Ernst & Young is coming in, and my question is that a result of the feedback that came back?
It could very well be, but the other possibility we have to look at is that Ernst & Young were brought in to cook the books more.
We don't know. Right.
I think either way it plays out, I think that one of the suggestions that you and I were talking about previously before we started recording is BIS, World Bank, International Monetary Fund have been trying to maneuver, I think, the SDR as a special drawing rights
right.
as kind of a basis for a global currency. Well, you're not going to be able to create a system like that without the Vatican Bank's involvement, because
right.
that bank, probably very similarly to BIS, has tentacles in almost every country in the world. So
right.
you've in a system like that, you've got to bring in the Vatican.
Well, that's
bank.
What we were talking about. And I
right.
see this, whatever's going on, and I don't think we begin to understand what's really going on, but I see this as a real, you know, like a bell ringing thing.
Yeah, it is.
It says, you know, here we have the Vatican, which is the largest pot of global equity.
Yeah.
So this is the ultimate intergenerational pool of equity.
Right.
And to me, it looks like it's aligning with the governor of the global currency.
Right.
And somewhere in there, we know the insurance, because the
yes.
third piece of this is insurance.
Yes.
And what it tells me is the system, the old model is not working as it's kind of coming down.
Right.
These institutions are melting into each other.
Now, the old model, just to refresh my memory, you're saying the old model, the central banking war
right.
model.
So we had
right.
a central banking warfare model. The central banks printed money,
right.
and they forced countries around the world to take that in exchange for natural resources. And if you go back at the history of who's run the reserve currency, basically the guy who's run the reserve currency controls the sea lanes,
right.
and he gets the benefit of being able to print paper and trade it, but then he has to pay for the military.
Right.
So we go back to the Holy Roman Empire's
right.
problem from the beginning, which is, can I generate enough money from currency debasement to pay for the military and manage the risk?
Well, let's look at a possibility here. If we were discussing earlier the idea that they need a new paradigm, they need a new type of system other than the central bank war model.
Right.
Okay. And that's, I think, pretty much everybody has agreed that that model has run its course. So how do you...
And I would say this. I think the financial coup d'etat was the leadership saying, it's run its course. We're going to pull as much capital
right.
out as we can, so that instead of spending the money on nursing homes and retirement, we have the money to build spacecraft and
right.
infrastructure. And so
right.
I think it was the anticipation of that. It was also a decision to go global, to,
right.
to globalize the infrastructure so you could go to a global currency.
Right. Now, let me add something to that model that I think is very intriguing. About a year and a half ago, I was talking with a friend of mine, and I mentioned the idea that eventually to create a global system, you're going to need a global currency. And to create a global currency that's going to have the acceptance and trust that you need for that sort of thing, you're going to have an institution backing it that has that kind of moral sanction. And there is a tailor-made institution, and that's the papacy. It has global claims. I mean, if you look at the claims of the papacy, it's a global claim. And if you look at the ancient model, which I outlined in Babylon's Banksters, you have the persistent association of central banks, if you will, or bullion brokers, as I call them in the book, with the temple, with religion. So that aspect of their model seems to be working out. Now, the reason I say that, in conjunction with what you just mentioned about space, is that it's very interesting to me that just prior to his resignation, you had, during the pontificate of Benedict XVI, you had a very curious, steady stream of Vatican stories, Vatican-sanctioned stories. These were in L'Osservatore Romano and other official Vatican rags. You had the stories of, okay, if we do encounter aliens, it's okay to baptize them. And you had a very highly placed cardinal, if I'm not mistaken, coming out in favor of the Vatican accepting the existence of extraterrestrials and so on. So there was a kind of a persistent off-the-radar.
Haven't they come out and said yes?
Yeah, they have. They have. And, you know, the big giveaway there was if we encounter any extraterrestrials, it will be okay to baptize them. In other words, make them members of the church.
Right.
So in other words, the claim now is being, the papal claim is being extended into space. So I think, again, this, all of these little dots connect and fit your model very, very well. They may be getting ready to bring in the papacy into whatever model they might be up to or creating that would involve space. I think that's a very, very high possibility.
Well, we know. It was up on your blog and our blog. Companies, you know, NASA has agreed to basically privatize the program.
Right.
So now companies are debating property rights
on the moon.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, and you add to that a moral sanction of, you know, the papacy, an institution with those kinds of claims, and you've got a new paradigm in the making, a new financial paradigm.
Although I will tell you, my read of the breakaway civilization was, you know, a lot of it really came out of Texas.
Yes.
And Colorado and the black budget interests, the defense interests there. And if you look at that group, they were very much competitive with the Vatican.
Oh, yes,
and
absolutely.
So they were trying to break away.
Yeah.
So if you look at the European financial interests that traditionally controlled this country and certainly controlled the initial investment into Texas,
right,
the building of the railroads,
right,
you know, they were trying to break away from that.
But we have to remember something as far as Vatican history goes. Let's go to something I mentioned in Financial Vipers of Venice, in the appendix that ends the book. I point out that Cardinal Giovanni Maria Mastai Ferretti, who becomes Pope Pius IX, who reigns as Pope for the longest period of any Pope in the entire history of the Roman Church, this is the man that was Pope and was pushing the definition of papal supremacy, immediate jurisdiction, and infallibility. But there's something else about him. There is a possibility that's mentioned in a cardinal of Chile that wrote a book called On the History of the Freemasons. And it was being alleged at that time that Pius IX himself may have been a member of the lodge. And I put at the beginning of that appendix a long quotation of Piccolo Tigre, who is speaking for the Carbonari Masonic lodges of Italy during the 19th century. And he says, well, how are we going to deal with the church? And effectively what he says is, we don't have to attack the church. All we have to do is recruit enough clergy into the lodges that eventually one of them is going to end up. And this is in 1849, incidentally. So it's a year after Mastai Ferretti becomes Pius IX. We only have to recruit somebody that will eventually end up as Pope. And then once we have that control over the papacy itself, we will be able to be doing pretty much what we want. Now, it's interesting to me that at the other end of the spectrum, in modern times, you have Father Malachi Martin, the famous Roman Catholic author that wrote books ahead of the curve, ahead of the news that broke. He wrote a book in 1978 talking then about claims that would come out eventually about Christ having a secret bloodline and secret children and so on and so forth. This is a full decade before Holy Blood, Holy Grail, the Messianic Legacy, Dan Brown, and all of that. He predicted that that would happen. So in other words, this is a Vatican insider leaking part of the game plan. Well, in his writings, he wrote a very famous book called Vatican. It's a novel, a thinly disguised novel about the details of modern Roman Catholic history. And in the book, he claims that after Pius IX lost the Papal States in the Italian unification, his successor, Leo XIII, made a bargain, and he calls it the bargain in the book, with the high Masonic powers of Europe that would allow the Vatican entry into the financial markets of Europe via the banks that they controlled. So what Martin is suggesting, and over and over in his book, his final book kind of completes the whole story, he's suggesting that there was a kind of a coup d'etat inside the Vatican itself. The papacy itself was captured by these financial powers. So in other words, we may be looking with this BIS story, we may be looking with Ernst & Young, the BIS auditors coming into the Vatican Bank, we may be looking at yet another possible scenario, and that's the final stage or the final completion of something that was begun in the 19th century. Right. That's a possibility, too. We're looking at a lot of stuff here.
Although Francis is a Jesuit.
Francis is a Jesuit, but that the Jesuits in Opus Dei, I think, have some very, very murky similarities to some of the Grand Orient lodges of Europe. And, you know, there are overlaps. The Jesuits would infiltrate some of these places.
You know, I have a bias, and it's far from one supported by facts, and that is that the, you know, the telecoms and the NSA network is a Masonic network.
Yeah,
and
it's
delivered a huge whack to the Catholic Church.
Oh, yes, I agree.
And so, in theory, this could, you know, and they've, in my lifetime, all I've seen of them is sort of, you know, the Templar tradition of let's get those guys back.
And, right.
You know, and the Scottish Enlightenment pull away.
Right.
And yet somehow it looks like a reconciliation is happening.
Yeah, I think that's a possibility. I'm one of those that looks at, you know, with my theological background, and I've always been very, very sympathetic to the liturgical churches. I'm one of those that looks at Vatican II from the ecclesiastical standpoint as an unmitigated disaster, because what the Roman Church effectively did was it gutted basically 2,000 years of its liturgical history. I mean, the Roman Catholic Mass that I remember was served at my grandparents' funerals is completely different from what you see going on in a Catholic church today. What you have in a Catholic church today is kind of a not even nicely done Protestant communion service. It's a far cry from the old Mass. Now, the reason that's significant is if you look at the documents of Vatican II, you see everything being thrown out the window. You know, the nuns are not in their habits, the monks are not in their habits. We're turning the altars around, we're getting rid of all the pretty vestments and bringing in all the ugly burlap and, you know, all of this stuff. And the only institution that connects you to previous Roman Catholic history that is spoken of in exactly the same traditional language of canon law is the papacy itself. So you really have a revolution, in my opinion, inside the Roman Catholic Church that's being orchestrated by a narrow group of people. And this is another thing we need to add into your scenario here, Catherine. People that have studied the Vatican Council will tell you that there was a certain segment of bishops, archbishops, and cardinals from southern Germany and Austria and Switzerland that showed up at the council in the first session and that were successful in getting the entire curial approved agenda completely thrown out and their own agenda substituted. Ratzinger, Benedict XVI, was one of the priests that was an expert advisor to Cardinal Koenig of Vienna. Okay, so in other words, he's part of this group of liberal revolutionaries that later goes on to become viewed as a conservative. Okay, he's one of the people leading the charge against all of this Gregorian chant and incense and, you know, all of the stuff that we associate with Roman Catholicism. There's actually a very famous book, a history of the Second Vatican Council by a Roman Catholic priest called The Rhine Flows Into the Tiber. Now, the reason that's significant is if you look at where the Bavarian Illuminati, the Grand Orient tradition of European revolution and assault against the church begins, it's precisely in this area of Germany and Austria that you find all of that stuff being orchestrated. So the way I look at it is that you may have the possibility, even at Vatican II, that that same group is moving in to the Vatican, taking it over, gutting the traditions of the church and leaving the papacy intact as a central authority. So again,
okay, so
we might
I'm
be looking
seeing,
at...
I'm looking at it financially.
Yeah, I understand.
I'm looking at the whole thing financially. What I see, and it's a pattern, I'm not saying it's true, but I'm just like a hat.
I'm just adding more to the pattern for you.
What I see is a group of highly conservative older leadership saying... We're in a fight for
our lives.
We're in a real fight, which means we got to get meaner and tougher. We need more central control of the capital, so we need, you know, sell all this real estate the nuns have created and bring the money in,
right?
And let them run around and be groovy, you know, in exchange to get control of the assets. And let's get a tighter control and less transparency, because the competition is turning mean. And we need a network that is going to run all this organized crime stuff.
That could be true, too.
And so we got to bring it into people we can trust to do that. So we got to get all these other people out, let them go be groovy.
That could be, too.
So I see them turning to the dark side, because that's the way the competition was going across the board.
Yeah, well, that's essentially what I'm saying. You had that turn to the dark side after Pius IX, and in my opinion, probably with Pius IX. Because we have to understand that.
And when was the Pope? When was the assassination?
John Paul II.
Yeah.
That was 1982, if I remember correctly.
See, that's when.
Yeah.
It was happening across the board.
Across the board, yes.
Yeah.
Well, I think we're looking at a very big pattern. Is the reason I'm bringing in all this history. It could be like what I'm suggesting here is. As you say, we're looking at an attempt to reestablish central authority and control. And that may be in reaction to all of this history that begins with Pius IX and the financial deals that were made under Leo XIII. And then we're seeing the final result now as the papacy is pushing back. That may be. It may also be we have to entertain the possibility that we're looking at Francis, who is attempting to reassert papal control precisely to represent those interests and weed out the other people, the barnacles that got attached to it.
There's no way to know, but I'll tell you why I think this headline is so important.
It's very important.
Is what it says is the model is evolving.
Oh, yes.
All these institutions, absolutely. You know, I have a great partner who always says fundamental economics matter.
Yes, yes.
And sometimes it can take a long time, but what you're seeing is whether it's this discussion of, you know, who owns what in space and what technology is going to be used in space, or my read of significant investments into an infrastructure to go into space, what we're also seeing is... literally a melding of all these institutions that have been at loggerheads are coming together because they have to.
And that's another possibility that I think is very possible. I mean, look at what we have. We have essentially the Venetian model being extended into space.
Right.
And, you know, lest we forget, the papacy played a role in all of this. You know, we all learned in school about the Pope, you know, spinning the globe and popping his finger to divvy up South America between Spain and Portugal, you know, the line of the line of demarcation. So, you know, it stands to reason that they would want to get the papacy on their side as they expand into space and maybe adjudicate claims. Who knows? But I think, yeah, I'm with you on this. This is a big story. And whatever scenario, you know, we're proposing, we're throwing out all sorts of stuff here. I think we have to look very carefully at the history of the papacy since Vatican I and the definition of infallibility, because what most people don't understand or don't realize is that the opposition to that definition came from precisely the same areas of Europe, from southern Germany, Austria, and right. In some cases, some French bishops were totally opposed to the definition.
There's another thing about the story which I find very interesting, which is, and this comes out of what you and I were talking about last night about the Americans being completely stopped over Syria.
Oh, yes.
They didn't even get to first base.
No.
And that's a big shift. And
that's a huge one.
That's a signal globally.
Yeah.
You know, the Americans can't control their own people.
Right.
So they're, and what you're seeing globally is institutions being subject to transparency.
Yes.
And they're struggling to deal with it. So the idea that the Pope would produce an annual report for the Vatican Bank, it's
unheard of.
I'm just like,
I'm
what?
Yeah, I'm like you. When I saw that, I was absolutely, you know, the British like to say gobsmacked, and I was. This is totally unheard of.
Well, but then to bring in EY.
And to bring in that firm. You know, we looked
from
it up last
night. From the city of London?
From the city of London.
What is going on?
And we found connections with that accounting firm and the Cleveland Federal Reserve and, you know, and Chicago.
You know, here's what happens. When you're in a marketplace, you know, there's an old rule, you can't fight the tape.
Right.
And what we're watching is, we are watching a tsunami of transparency.
Yeah.
And a shift in the field as a result.
Yeah.
And all of these institutions are having to literally obey.
Yeah.
They are melting, they are evolving, because it is a real force. And, you know, how it goes from here, I don't know. But what it tells me is the financial coup d'etat is over, the breakaways pulled the money out. That money is running around doing what it's doing, and now everybody's having to shift.
Yep.
So the chairs are shifting, and this conversation about what's the new model going to be is coming to the fore.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. This move, like I say, it may be, my bet is these people that are looking at all this and having to wrestle with the evolution of a new model and be on the cusp of it and control it, they're not going to forget their own history. And the biggest part of that history, it's been so much a part of their playbook since ancient times, is the alignment between finance and religion.
Right.
And that part of it, I think, you know, that part of it, at least I'm relatively certain that's what we're looking at here. But, pardon me, what it represents is another matter. We could be looking at some real pushback from the Vatican. We could be looking at some real push in on the part of the Western financial oligarchy further into the Vatican, you know, the final stage.
Who knows?
You know, who knows? So it's important everybody keep their eyes open on this one. This is a huge story.
Yeah, we're not telling you what we know. We don't know.
No, we don't know anything. We're brainstorming and throwing ideas out there because this is a huge story.
Well, but sometimes I think it's, you know, when you don't know and when you're dealing with uncertainty, I think it's very important to do this kind of brainstorming.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Because it's by doing it that you find...
You find what to look for.
Yeah. And, well, the financial model is evolving and we're, you know, we won't get into it. We'll get it the next time we do the Slater Report, your new book, Financial Vipers. But, you know, to me... the financial system is an interesting balance between enforcement,
yes,
which depends on force, and the sacred.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, we always try and dovetail those with the rule of law.
Right.
You know, and the rule of law, the law is a, you know, supposedly evolves from the fundamentals of economics and the sacred, and enforcement enforces the law. But of course, we know we've gotten way off track.
Let me add one thing to that model, something that people will have to look for. And that's the ecclesiastical part of the story. The Roman Church views the Orthodox Church as having split from it.
Right.
The Orthodox Church views the Roman Church as having split from it.
Right.
So in other words, you have two Catholic churches here, both with their differing claims that are mutually contradictory. To make the system work, you are going to have to bring in the Orthodox Church back into the Roman obedience. If, on the other hand, the Roman Church looks like it is willing to concede some major doctrinal points to the Orthodox Church, that's a deep signal that things may not be going the way that the Western financial elite wants. And guess who is basically the representative of Orthodox culture?
Putin.
Yeah. So this is going to be a very interesting
game to watch.
Putin's the stinker, and the other big stinker is the Orthodox Church. That's the other problem that they're going to have.
Right. They don't want to be run by corporations.
No. I can tell you that. I can tell you that from long experience.
It's really funny. I had a wonderful subscriber email me about it 6 months ago, and he said, "Oh, now I realize. Now I realize what you mean. If they get the central banking locked down globally, then do you know what they can do to us at that point?" And I said, "Oh, yes. Pray for Syria.
Yeah, pray for Syria." And, you know, you're right. That's the other thing. People need to pray against this consolidation, because it's not going to be good if they get away with it.
Well, here's the what some would argue is the reason they want consolidation is they want the human race to speak with one voice if they're going to go into space.
Right. That I can readily appreciate.
And so the question is, how do you do that?
Right.
And that's why this dance in the G20 is so interesting.
Well, the other possibility here, since we've mentioned space as kind of the hidden backdrop to all of this, let's just assume for the sake of argument that they've already made some sort of contact and that some sort of trade may be underway. Well, what are you going to trade and with whom and how?
Gold.
Yeah, bingo. So, got to get that gold, folks.
Where is all that GLD gold going?
Yeah, bingo.
They bought the moon.
They bought the moon.
Oh, Lord. It's such an amazing experience to live on a planet where everything is a mystery.
It is. And getting more mysterious by the day.
There's a wonderful Pulp Fiction novel that a friend of mine gave me about 5 years ago about the second coming of Jesus Christ, except Jesus comes back as a woman.
Oh, no.
So Jesus, in the form of a woman, goes to the Vatican to confront the whole Vatican hierarchy, goes into the library, throws open the library, brings the media cameras down, and gets, you know, starts dishing out the dirt from the Vatican library. It's very fun. You know, but the challenge we have with the transparency rising is, you know, we're all going to have to be sin eaters, because we're all going to have to look in the mirror and face what we've been doing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, a lot of these institutions have managed the double binds and protected us from the double binds, and now it's going to come out.
Yeah.
And so the question is, part of getting to the new model is, how are we going to integrate the facts of our manifold sins and then proceed to build a new model which is economically productive? And of course, the opportunity is, it's much more pleasant to have a wealth building model than a wealth destroying one.
Yes. But, well, you know, it's again, the model there is very interesting, that you bring space into it because, you know, I talked in Covert Wars and Clash of Civilizations about the report from Iron Mountain and space again. You know, even though this is a completely hoaxed report, when you compare what it's saying to what's going on at that period of history, it's that report's coming out of kind of the post-Camelot, post-Kennedy assassination culture, and this is precisely what Kennedy's vision was.
Okay, so before we get into this, I just want to tell you my little tidbit on the report for Iron Mountain.
Okay.
My grandfather went to the Rockefeller Foundation to run social sciences.
Okay.
From 39 on to into the early 50s, I guess. And when the report was written.
Right.
So he was the head of social sciences when the report was
written. Oh, wow.
And our family farm was on Iron Mountain. And in fact, he was there every summer. And the Rockefeller Foundation paid for the phone line to be run up to the farm. We didn't have a phone until they paid. They said they needed him. And so, you know, he had to have a phone. And so, you know, our joke was our farm phone was paid for by the Rockefeller Foundation. My sister goes to Swarthmore and becomes an activist and immediately concludes that report from Iron Mountain relates to our family farm at Iron Mountain, which my grandfather insisted absolutely was not true. But it was as a result, everybody in our family had to
read the report from Iron Mountain.
And I always thought it alluded to, you know, the top storage company for financial institutions is a company called Iron Mountain. And the FDIC requires banks to deliver their backup tapes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, very interesting little tidbit.
No, I didn't know that at all.
Yeah, that you could do a lot with that.
Oh, yeah, one could just write novels about that.
I think it's in Tarrytown.
Oh, really?
You could write a novel. Yeah, so you might want to check out that tidbit. But Report for Iron Mountain basically says, look, the only way the population will continue to support the war machine is they'll support space, and of course that's what Kennedy was doing.
Right.
Kennedy was taking us into space.
Right. And, you know, space is a nice, convenient way for them to keep the model and appear to change it because, yeah, you can pretend or actually have a war in space, and it's not going, if you're lucky, it's not going to involve resources or destruction on this planet. So, yeah, it's. I think we're looking at something.
The interesting thing. If you look at the military budget, one of the big questions in reengineering the federal budget in this country is the military budget for many, many decades has been run on a cost-plus basis.
Mm-hmm.
And a cost-plus basis has been a way of keeping hundreds of thousands of people employed in a way that's not necessarily the most productive.
Right.
But it's a think of it as a massive job program and a sort of political management program because, you know, you've got everybody on your payroll. We now have the opportunity, if the population will support going into space, to say, okay, let's re-engineer something much more productive, not just in terms of lowering the expenses, but increasing profits.
Absolutely.
Okay, so if you come back to Lockheed Martin's stock this year.
That's going up.
It's flying to the moon, literally.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and this is a company that's always, you know, essentially traded sideways. This is a cost-plus company. It's certainly not behaving like a cost-plus company in a world where technology is stagnant and the budget's being re-engineered.
Right.
So, to me, I think
that's a sign. Something else is going on.
I think one of the most important signs you can get, you know, if you look at what they're doing in North America, if you look at what they're doing with the railroad system, if you look at the transportation system, if you look at letting the fabrication technology line shift. The conversation about both renewable energy, breakthrough energy, they're looking to create a very decentralized but domestic energy self-sufficiency, not dependent on just fossil fuels, but renewables, and lots of conversation about more, you know, more breakthrough kind of stuff. I mean, all of that says to me they're looking to significantly increase the output of the military-industrial complex.
Yes.
At a much reduced cost, but where profitability is higher than it is.
Yeah.
So they're going to an entrepreneurial model, which they can do if the population will support.
And in addition, there's something else in play there, too, I think. I think they're trying to increase whatever it is they're able to produce. They're trying to increase production.
By a huge amount.
By a huge amount. And that, to me, you know, that was kind of the argument I was trying to make in Covert Wars and Clash of Civilizations, that this advanced technology is very expensive.
Right.
And it's not necessarily that we can't emulate the performance of UFOs. We can't keep up with production.
Right. And we can emulate it. It's just, if you look at the new composite materials, they're fantastically expensive.
Yeah.
You've got to get them. You've got to re-engineer the price down radically.
Yes. Yeah. You have to not only do that, but you also have to, if there is a potential real threat out there, and I think there's no other way that the breakaway civilization could have read the situation. If there is a real potential threat, then you also have to not only increase the production and show that it's increased, but you have to disperse it. You know, centralized production facilities are nice targets. You know, right. I hate to put it so bluntly, but that's right. Exactly the truth.
Well, there's the one thing I think it's really important for everyone to understand is that, and you make this clear in your latest book, no engagement between a technologically advanced civilization and a less advanced civilization has ever historically, that I know of, come out well for the less technologically advanced. No. So whatever the breakaway civilization has been up to, they're trying to jump the curve.
They are trying to jump the curve. And
historically, the argument, if they seem paranoid, they have a good reason.
They have a good reason. And this brings us back to what's going on financially. We're in kind of, as far as the technology, UFO, space problems concerned, I put it in the book that we're in the kind of a Tower of Babel moment of history that begins more or less sometime in the middle of World War II and has continued up to now. And they've got to negotiate through this period of history and stave off or bluff whatever threat they think that they're dealing with until they can get the situation of the technology and the production straightened out down here. And I think that's the other factor that we're looking at, is with this retrenchment, increase of production, dispersal of production, that's the hidden game that they're playing. It has to be the hidden game. There's too much money awash in the system, and there's too much money disappearing into the black budget to indicate anything else.
Right. And, the funniest situation, though, is for many, since 1980, we have been in a period of falling yields in the bond market and a bull market in bonds.
Mm-hmm.
And that is now coming to an end.
To an end, yeah.
And so, despite Larry Summers promoting negative interest rates... So on Friday, the EU rejected the negative interest rate concept.
Gosh, go figure.
So, thank you, Mario. So, but Ben did give his blessing to Bitcoin. So,
yeah, this is true.
Well, think of it. What a wonderful way. If you're printing this much money, you're looking for anything that can sop up money. And to me, that's scary, because if Ben is saying, yes, they want to prototype digital global currencies, but I think he's looking for anything to soak up huge money that won't create inflation on mainstream.
Right.
So it goes off into cyberspace. Okay, so we've been in this long-term drop in interest rates. And what's interesting is I sat down and did the calculations. I realized anybody who's 40 years or less in age has never lived in a world where there wasn't cheaper and cheaper capital.
Now,
whether it was, and that fueled enormous spending by governments.
Yeah.
And it fueled enormous availability of consumer credit.
Mm-hmm.
It fueled, mortgages and housing credit. Now it's coming to an end.
Yes.
Now, if the central banks can manage to hold it down without even exploding the shadow banking and derivative systems even more than they have, maybe they can hold it flat, but it certainly can't keep coming down, which means they have to shift to a world where everything's equity.
Yeah.
Now, here's the interesting thing about equity. Equity systems, I keep saying it on the Solari Report, Americans own equity, whether directly or through their pension funds. Around the world, almost nobody owns equity. It's all in the value, it's managed institutionally. If that should change, and there's many signals to indicate that it's being engineered to change, if we should go to a world where most people are vested in the equity, you're talking about a world of much higher transparency and much greater cooperation.
Yep.
You know, and I always say debt equals war.
Yep.
Equity equals peace.
Yep.
If that's the case, we're in for, from a financial standpoint, a phenomenal change.
Yes.
In the allocation of capital, how capital's priced, and the incentive systems to collaborate.
Yes. It's a total cultural transformation we're looking at.
Right.
And it's qualitatively different than anything in previous human history. And it is, like it or not, it is a globally integrative cultural trend.
Right.
It doesn't mean you're not going to have conflicts or factional fights or things of this sort, but it's going to be very different than what we see now.
Very different.
And if you are in that process of transition and suddenly introduce a factor that would threaten the transition, that's going to accelerate it.
Right.
So I think that's the other thing to keep in mind here as we're watching the space news is watch very carefully how they might be preparing us for whatever. The introduction of that idea or broadened international cooperation in space. In that respect, I think it's very interesting that recently, very quietly, the United States and Russia, which are at loggerheads almost on everything else, are talking about asteroid defense systems.
Right.
Well, you know, that's very interesting.
I always keep worrying that Doris Lessing's novels are really coming true.
Yeah. It's bizarre.
Okay, well, that's it for this impromptu conversation.
Well, it's been fun.
It has been fun. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you.
You know, we talked about covert wars on the last Salieri Report. I would love it if you would just give a 2-minute overview of Financial Vipers.
Well, Financial Vipers, what I was trying to do in that book was show not only the mechanisms of the Venetian state, but the hidden oligarchical playbook that they used to manipulate things. Bullion prices, crashing competitors' businesses thereby, you know. And the other thing I wanted to do, the second major point of the book that I really started with Babylon's Banksters, is to try and show the connection between cosmology or cosmological physics and finance. There's a
deep connection
that people just really have to latch on to understand.
It's a deep, deep connection, and I was really glad to see you bring it up. And it's for those who haven't explored it, it's a new thing. But it's certainly, as we go into whatever this reinvention of models is, it's one that, you know, it's going to take us back to the basics.
Yeah, it
and
is.
And that's going to include the relationship between, I would say, between physics and cosmology and the sacred and money.
And money, yes, absolutely. Yeah.
It's
absolutely
at the very heart of the field.
Yep, it is. Yeah. It is.
Okay. Well, Dr. Joseph Farrell, always a pleasure.
Well, thank you for
having
me back.
Thank you for this unexpected impromptu.
Well, it's been a fun visit, I got to tell you. It's... we should probably record them because
we might as well. Ladies and gentlemen, have a great weekend.